Hold on loosely, it's time for the SAFTAcast, and I'm your host, Scott C. How you doing, folks?
You doing good?
Hope you're doing good. Yeah. Hope you talk to your doctor and helping you with that little issue that you're having right now. Folks, Ep 16 is here with Darren C. Demery on the program. It's a good one, folks, and you're going to like this one because I know I liked it, and you can trust my judgment on these sort of things, you know? Some updates for you, though, from the SunTrust Academy for the Arts. Two big events coming up in just the near future here. What are you doing the day after Halloween? Are you doing anything special for Day of the Dead? Just going to sit around and wear off the candy shock or the horror movies you watched or whatever? I got something for you. November 1st, from 12 to 5 p.m. at the Firefly Farms in Knoxville, Tennessee, the home of the SunTrust Academy for the Arts, is the next SAFTA workshop. This time it is visual translation, talking about translation and adaptation, taking works, how do you preserve the integrity of the original text while still bringing it into another language. Your host this time around is the one and the only Nicole Aquindo, the managing editor for the Florida Review. This is going to be a good one, folks, especially if you're interested in translation poetry and fiction as well. It's going to cover all the bases, trust me on this one. You can get your tickets now, and you can get them at the SunTrust Academy for the Arts store at sundresspublications.com and click on store at the top of the page. Just 8 days later. Just eight. It's time for the SunTrust Reading Series once again at the Birdhouse in Knoxville, Tennessee at 3 p.m. on Sunday, November the 9th. This award-winning SAFTA Reading Series returns, this time with featured poets Maureen Thompson and Darius Stewart. These are two great poets. I encourage you to check out their work online, because seriously, you will be blown away and you will want to get a hold of them, and you'll want to see this thing. So today's show features the one and the only Darren C. Demery on the program, as I mentioned a moment ago, chatting about a whole number of things, ranging from what makes for good country music to posing some very powerful existential questions about modern pop culture, namely Kanye West's eating habits. We also talk a little bit about his newest volume, which was just dropped just before this interview, the week of this interview that we recorded it, the book Temporary Champions, available through Main Street Rag on the online bookstore. We'll put that link up on the website if you didn't already see it. This is a good one. Just reading some of the samples on the website and talking with Darren about the book a little bit at the end of the program. Just, yeah, let's get to it in just a moment. First, you gotta taste the theme song. Goes down nice and smooth. Darren!
Yes, sir. 1 second here. My camera's... There we go.
Don't worry about video.
Sure thing.
Plus, it makes me feel like I'm more on radio.
Because I'm looking at the picture of you. You're mid-sip all the time.
Well, it's not going to be that different because I actually have a large cup of coffee next to me, so...
Damn straight.
There you go. So, Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So let me start off real, I got to start off with the burning question that is on everybody's mind.
Oh, wow.
And today our question is this. How do I know when it's love?
How do I know it's love? Depends on what kind of love we're talking about, but it can be love in a lot of different ways. If we're talking about romantic love, it can be something as simple as an attraction. It can be something as complex as missing someone when they're gone. I don't know. Other kinds of love, familial love, parental love, that's a little more literal. But in terms of romantic love, it all tends to hit us differently.
That's probably the smartest answer to the question I've ever heard.
Okay.
Because usually I think of it just more of Van Halen, who posed the question, how do I know when it's love? I don't know.
Well, that's a valid response. I think we know too often all the degrees of love. And we declare it love when it gets, what, above 15 or 20% love? We'll call it love.
We poets are weird.
This is true.
We have been trying to figure out the meaning of love for 2,000 years, and we're no closer than we were.
No, and we've compared it to many things. So we'll just keep doing that, and some of us will get a career out of it.
Have you ever tried to describe love in a poem?
No, I think the closest I've come is tried to describe circumstances of love. I think if you just try to describe love, it ends up being sort of boring and trite. Even if you go sort of over the top and you make it weird and wild, that's even been done enough. So it's much more fun to dissect it, tear it apart, and rate it one way or the other than to just try to define it.
Makes it very clinical then.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the emotions come from not a clinical place, but if you spend enough time looking into it, even the smallest fraction of it's going to be something worth dissecting a little bit.
I wonder if scientists try to qualify and quantify their love for one another.
I think they have, haven't they? Haven't there been studies done and things like that? Gauging the chemical level, endorphins, all sort of physical reactions to the love stimulus, both physical and emotional. But they always seem to be almost as much of a lost as the poets are when it comes to defining it.
My personal definition that I once wrote down was that love is the reason why country music exists.
both love and the absence of love?
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's the only definition I have at this point, and I've tried for, 20 years to do it?
Well, without love, George Jones would not have made a record called Divorce or Destroy. So, you know, it does some good work.
This is very true. And not only that, you pull out a more obscure George Jones album.
Well, I was, there's a great record store in Columbus called Used Kids. I was there and I bought a cassette tape of Divorce or Destroy when I still had a car with a cassette tape player in it. It's fantastic. All the songs are just ruthless.
They are. Well, George Jones in general was ruthless.
Pretty much.
Any listener just can go and Google George Jones on the lawnmower. That's all you need to know.
Yeah. I tried to explain to one of my writing classes about George Jones, and a couple of them were country music fans, but they liked some of the more modern things. And I said, well, what decides if your country music is worth anything is whether or not George Jones would shoot you or not. If he let you live after you were in his crosshairs, then you were probably worth something.
That's probably the best definition of country music I have ever heard.
I mean, that makes sense to me. Ever since I heard this story about him having Tanya Tucker in his crosshairs and sparing her, I've had much more respect for Tanya Tucker.
Are you much of a country music fan in general?
No, not so much. I like some of the really old, sad stuff. I like some of the offshoots of things that have come out of it recently. I mean, it gets termed alternative country, some of the things that merges with Americana and folk and things like that. So, like, my favorite band is from Memphis, Lucero, and they've got some country influence to them, but they're much more of a, I guess, a rock band than anything else.
I haven't heard of them. I might have to check them out.
Yeah. But I like any of the sad bastard drunken country music stuff. That's good to me.
Give me the outlaw movement and I'm a happy guy.
Pretty much. My all-time favorite country song is George Jones's If the Drinking Don't Kill Me, Her Memory Will.
It's a brutal song.
It is. It is.
And I'm happy to know that George Jones never really softened as he got older.
No, he was just a mean old bastard till the end. It's a good thing.
He mellowed a little bit, but never truly that much.
Well, we've all got a center, and I don't think he went too far away from his ever.
No, he kind of stayed true to his essence there.
Pretty much.
Okay, other music that you dig? I'm curious.
Well, this week I got to see one of my favorites, Corey Brannan. He's on Bloodshot Records. He's actually old friends with the lead singer of Lucero, Ben Nichols. And he came into town, and I got to see him. There's a Columbus girl named Lydia Lovelace, who's pretty great. I sent one of her CDs down with the SAFTA crew after Aaron visited Columbus. And she's great. She's young. She's still only 21, 22, and she's just incredible.
Kind of a folk pop rock type thing, I'm guessing?
She goes a little more drunken country kind of thing. She likes pop music, but she takes that and puts it into drunk country. So it's fun.
So it's not kind of like what we're seeing in modern country where it's trying to do the real pop crossover hit.
No, she herself is normally too inebriated to really keep it together.
I respect artists like that.
Music-wise, when I was in grad school, I had friends in punk pop bands, and I got real into the really great, like, minute-and-a-half, two-minute songs. I like Josh Ritter. I still like, every so often, like, a hip-hop album will come out that's just awesome, and I'll listen to that. Trying to think of what we were listening to this morning in the house. Oh, my kids like any sort of real catchy pop music, so we end up listening to Katy Perry in the house every so often, or Taylor Swift, or anything my 5-year-old daughter can dance to.
You gotta start schooling them then on the good stuff.
Well, I play the good stuff too, and I let it seep in. I let it, you know, every once in a while I'll catch, like my daughter knew the words to a Jessica Lee Mayfield song for a little while. And I was pretty proud of that.
It'll ingrain in their heads. Trust me on that one.
Yeah. They'll rebel against it and then love it by the time they're 20, 25.
They'll seek out the albums and go, this is what Dad used to play.
There you go. I've got a copy of Tom Waits's Small Change, which is my favorite album. And at some point I'll put it on for my daughter to listen to. She's probably got to be, what, 16 to listen to that?
I would say, yeah, just in general for Tom Waits, yeah.
Just in general. And so I'll put that on for her when she's 16, and we'll see how it goes from there.
Why is Small Change your favorite album? Because I know other... I would think that the big one is Mule Variations. So many people love that one.
Sure.
Why is Small Change your favorite?
Well, for a Tom Waits album, it's a hell of a lot of fun. I mean, it's got some of the more morose, really sort of beautiful Tom Waits on it. But it's got some of that, the song about pasties in a G-string, and... It's just got some fun, sort of weird and wild lyrics on it that I enjoy listening to all the time, essentially. So I'll probably listen to Small Change about once a month and really thoroughly enjoy it every single time.
Listen to it straight through.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's one of the things where I grew up in Mount Vernon, and which is about an hour northeast of where I'm living now. And if I'm going to go to Mount Vernon, it's about the same length drive as Small Change, and I'll just put it on.
There you go. Perfect road trip music. Normally, I wouldn't consider Tom Waits to be road trip music, though.
No, but I think that's one of the reasons why Small Change is my favorite, because it's there's no, like, you don't get lost. It's not a dearth to the music. I mean, if some of the Tom Waits albums, it just sort of swallows you at a certain point. And Small Change has enough weird and wild to it that it's infinitely listenable to me.
Have you always been a big Tom Waits fan?
I'd say a lot of my music that I'm really into now happened when I was in grad school, and I had friends who were in bands and things that just kept putting music in front of me. And I knew who Tom Waits was, but I never listened to Tom Waits till, you know, probably about a decade ago. And it's been one of the ones that stuck and never went away.
What is the appeal of Tom Waits? I'm not dumping on him by any means, but I'm curious why you see him as a great artist.
Well, I don't know if I think he's as great as a lot. Small Change is just one of the albums that I think is untouchable, incredible. But I can't listen to, like, I got the Orphans, the 3-disc thing that came out, all the songs that were sort of small releases and B-sides and things like that. And other than maybe about a third of those songs, it's not great. And I don't love every Tom Waits album. I think there's a lot of, he tries a lot of things and a lot of them don't hit for me. But Small Change really, really does.
I can understand. Mule Variations, very popular album. It was the most stolen album when I worked at my college radio station.
Understandable.
And I only love about half the album.
Yeah.
Like, every other song I love.
Well, I mean, you said great artist. I think he's brilliant, but I think he tries so many things that it's never going to be, you know, he's not an unimpeachable artist. I think he's brilliant, but, you know, he's gonna misstep.
I wonder why he isn't classified then as experimental rock.
You know, I'd put him, especially, you know, like 80s, 90s, I think he was, you know, he'd gotten famous and had been famous for just a little while. And I think, you know, that's what he was doing. He was trying new things.
Yeah, there was a definite Tom Waits resurgence in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
He fell off a lot of people's radar in the 80s, as many artists did, and then found this strong revival in college radio, and then MTV grabbed him for Unplugged.
Right.
So he had a massive resurgence then. I don't think he's slowed down since, really.
No, he's still putting things out, and he's still touring. He came to Columbus, I think it was like a year ago.
Did you get to see him?
No, I missed it. It was one of the things where I think I was outpriced on it. I think it was a $60 or $70 show. And one of my sort of side gigs is I started a website called Alt Ohio. And I've got a friend running it for me now. But I'm used to getting into the shows for free, and there was no way to get into the Tom Waits show for free. So
no, I understand.
Yeah,
for certain artists, I might pay $70, but
you know what? If it was at a smaller place, the venue was a little bit bigger. If he was going to play one of the places that only fit, you know, 100 or 200 people, I think that might be worth it to have that kind of experience. But I think it was a 500,000 seat, you know.
I couldn't deal with Tom Waits in that setting. A smaller setting, you're right, like a small forum or
sure.
Auditorium.
Like he came to a college to play or something like that, and you could get in to see that, that'd be pretty great.
He demands more of an intimate setting, I think.
Sure, and I think he'd be more interesting. I think when he puts on a show, he does a lot of talking, and I think that'd be interesting just to hear him talk more as much as to hear him perform the music.
Yeah, in our last episode here of the Saftcast, we were discussing that a little bit. He was the one artist I would love to have a steak dinner with.
You know what? That's good. That would be good. Trying to think of who else would fit under that steak dinner.
Who would you have a steak dinner with? A musical celebrity, living.
Musicals. I'd love to talk to Josh Ritter a little bit because I think he's a pretty great writer. Leonard Cohen obviously jumps to the list, but I'm not sure you'd get actually much of a conversation out of Leonard Cohen. Whenever I hear him speak on things, it's always pretty abstract to get much out of it. Who else would I like to talk to? I don't know. There are some like more famous musicians that would just be, you just want to hear the crazy things that they would say. Like having a steak dinner with Kanye West, if he would eat steak, would be something that'd probably be hilarious.
Is steak beneath Kanye?
I think it might be. I think he'd want something a little finer. I don't know. When I spend my good money, it's on a steak. I don't know what Kanye West spends his good money on.
I don't want to even speculate.
No.
Except to say, maybe Kanye.
Maybe. You never know.
I would also like to do it with Henry Rollins.
Okay. Yeah, I'd buy that. He's a really interesting guy. Think of the different places he's been and the different things he's done. He's got incredible stories, I'm sure.
I don't know. Tom Waits, I keep coming back to him because it would be the most fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
You know, cows.
You just want to hear him
fields.
Talk.
Yeah, I just want to hear him talk, you know.
It was last year. Eric Clapton lives in Columbus now. He married an Ohio girl, and he lives in Columbus, and we were out at dinner.
Really?
Yeah. He ended up sitting a table away from us, and I was very thankful that neither of my children threw any food at Eric Clapton. I was proud of that.
I can only wonder what would that conversation have been like.
You know, he was there with a bunch of people, including some kids, so he might have been cool about it, but you don't want that to be part of their legacy.
No, you really don't want, next thing you know, to be like three big guys with creases in the forehead and earpieces coming over and grabbing you.
You know, I didn't see any security, but, you know, there were some guys that if they wanted to, they could have roughed me up. I'm not quite 5'10", about 170. They probably could have done some damage.
Do you have many celebrity sightings in Ohio?
It was before Eric Clapton. I think I've seen LeBron James twice now. He comes down to Columbus from time to time. But other than that, no, not really. You know, not many people wandering around Columbus.
Have you had many celebrity experiences in general?
Not really. When I was a kid, my dad liked to go get autographs from athletes and things like that. And so I got to meet a lot of athletes that way. But not too many. I've never met any movie stars or any musicians that I've got to interview or talk to. Haven't been of the most famous variety. I got to interview Scott Abbott once, and that was cool. But the other people that I've got to spend time with have been more just sort of my favorite people that aren't really necessarily famous, like William Elliott Whitmore or Corey Brannan, that aren't necessarily famous, but just fantastic people that I was happy to meet.
Writers aside, obviously.
Sure. Well, and, you know, we did a big, I did grad school at Miami University here in Ohio, and we had the first ever African-American poetry festival that Ohio had hosted while I was there. And I got to meet Natasha Trethewey and Terrence Hayes and big name people that were very sweet and very nice. My favorite of which, unfortunately, died last year was Wanda Coleman. Wanda Coleman was a fantastic lady. She came to the graduate students reading, stayed for the whole thing. We danced for like five or six songs. She just kept complimenting me and just being so sweet and saying, you know, she was going to come back to Oxford, Ohio, and she was going to read first. She was going to open up for me, which just an incredibly sweet lady to say things like that.
That is pretty damn awesome, yeah.
Dancing with Wanda Coleman is up there on my list.
That's a title for a book right there.
Yeah. Yep.
Future book title for you. You can take that because there's no way I could take that one.
You could do it as a work of fiction. It'd be a story.
I find now that I'm turning more toward my eye of thinking, I really want to start doing some nonfiction essay work.
Those are always fun, sure. You've got some ornery feelings and you'd like to get them out. I understand.
Exactly, but in a humorous, non-offensive manner.
Sure.
Well, non-offensive to casual readers, but...
Yeah, okay.
But definitely offensive to those who it's going after.
Right. Well, you don't want to be toothless, but you don't want to bite anyone's arm off. I understand. Just shake them a little bit, like when my dogs find a rabbit, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't want to kill them. I just want to make them bleed.
Yes, I understand.
Would you say, though, meeting writers and everything, that are most of them pretty cool? Or have you ever run into, you don't have to name names, obviously, have you ever run into D-bags?
Yeah, of course. I grew up in sort of the athletic sort of demigod culture, where you looked on the people you looked up to were famous and rich, and you sort of held them up on a pedestal. When my life became sort of all about writing, trying to join that community and getting to meet some of the higher ups, it was interesting to me to how personable they were, because being raised in a sports culture, there was such a distance between you and your favorite athletes. There's not that sort of distance really between you and, say, your favorite poets. Maybe some of the more famous, you know, fiction writers there is, but I've gotten, for the most part, to meet a lot of my favorite poets, and most of them have been incredibly nice and gracious and sweet people. But there are some that are either lost in their own world, socially inept, or just sort of bastards. You know, I've met some of those too. But for the most part, you know, the majority of them have been really nice and kind and even extended themselves a little bit. I got to meet C.K. Williams this spring. I was a visiting writer at University of Wisconsin-Superior for a weekend. And I got to, he did a reading in Duluth, just north of Superior. And he was the nicest guy. We were talking boxing poems and all sorts of different things. And he was just great and personable for about half hour with me. Asked me to send him an email, all this stuff. So for the most part, even some of the big name award-winning people, they've been great. And there have been about, maybe let's say, half dozen to 10 that have just been interminably awful. Just not nice people.
So let's focus on the positive for a second here. Why do you think that is among writers, that we're more personable and more gregarious than, say, sporting worlds?
I think the easiest answer is the money, maybe. I mean, even the most famous award-winning poet isn't going to have generational wealth. They might be well off. And also, you know, even if you're spending a lot of time working on something alone, most writers are teachers, I think. Most writers want to engage in the world on a, when they do, it's on a person-to-person level. It's not in front of 50,000 people. So I think the relationship's different. I think the teacher thing probably, you know, plays a big role on it. And if you're a poet or not an incredibly famous fiction writer, you sort of need to be part of the community to move your work almost. If you piss everyone off, no one's going to buy your books. That doesn't hold true for everyone, but, you know, I think being a good person helps.
Couldn't hurt.
Yeah.
Can't hurt at all. Maybe you're right. When you are up against 50,000 people who know your name or are aware of your existence.
Sure.
Because you might be a lesser known player, you know, in football, maybe you're just the right tackle or something.
Right, right.
Versus a writer who is speaking to a crowd of 30.
And a lot of times, I mean, they've with online magazines and journals and things like that, there's more pictures of writers these days. But for a long time, you know, writers were, you know, pretty faceless. Obviously, television and then the internet changed a lot of that. But there's a lot more on personal exchanges between writers than there is just being watched.
You know, I think Twitter and YouTube and such have really changed the game for writers in terms of interaction.
Yep.
My students will contact some of the writers that we read during a semester, and they're very personable.
Sure.
Exchanging jokes, cracking wise with each other. I'm amazed.
Well, and that makes it fun. I mean, that makes the world that can be a pretty small place sometimes that much bigger. And anyone who's wanting to engage in conversation and jokes and things like that, that's fantastic. There's a MFA student, and I'm unfortunately forgetting his name right now, at Ashland University. Here in Ohio, and I'd been writing these 9-word poems after each Cleveland Indians game. And I'd done it for 3 seasons at this point, and he sent me a shout-out on Twitter that he liked it so much he was going to start doing it for Columbus Blue Jackets games, for hockey games. And so he sent me a shout-out and thanked me for doing it, and now he's gonna do it in his own right for hockey. And I thought that was great for him to send me the note, and that's just sort of a fun little twist on what Twitter and social media can do when it's maybe at its best.
There's also, I'm trying to remember what it was like for me being a student, and you see somebody has a published book and you're reading them, you are a little bit starstruck.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think that, especially if it's someone who's you know, really well known, that's gotta be a big deal to them. I know if when I was a student, it would have been a big deal to get an email back from a writer I liked or anything like that. It would have been huge.
Do you think you still get starstruck over writers?
I get excited about certain writers when they've got books out that are new that I, you know, and when I've got to meet, you know, like Trethewey and Hayes and some other people like that, I was starstruck when I met them. Part of it is both of those, both Natasha Trethewey and Terrence Hayes are beautiful people to look at. They're just beautiful people. And we were sort of all figuring out how fantastic they both were as writers, because this was about 11 years ago. And this is before they won any sort of big awards and things like that. But it was sort of daunting to hear them read, and to sort of, they had a presence to them. And I think that can sort of make people starstruck just the way some people can carry themselves and control a crowd.
I wonder, because sometimes there's talked about, like Dave Chappelle has mentioned that when Kanye was on the Dave Chappelle show, he knew, this is long before Kanye became Kanye.
Right.
He knew there was something about this guy that was going to be big time. Did you get, and you're saying you got the same sense off of like Trethewey and Hayes and others.
Yeah, well, Natasha was a very sweet lady. Terrence Hayes has some gravitas to him. I mean, that man can control a room like very few poets I've seen. Part of it's reading style, part of it's his own confidence, part of it is all of that, and he's still sort of a gentle, nice guy. And I think there are certain people that can walk into a room and control it. And I don't think that needs to be a data on a daily basis sort of thing, but it's something that I try to take into when I do readings and things like that, is try to have that sort of esteem and try to carry yourself in a way that can make the performance better, at least.
You never know who's in that audience.
Sure. And I think there are writers that get put in those rooms that can't handle any sort of performance situation. And even if they're great writers, they can flounder in that under those circumstances. When I was in grad school, there was Rosanna Warren came and visited us, Robert Penn Warren's daughter, I believe. And she came to visit us, and she had some okay poems, but she was a thud. She came in the room, and it was one of the worst hours I've spent with poetry. And she just wasn't excited to be there, and wasn't excited about the poems, and wasn't excited about us, and it was difficult. I think if you're going to walk into a room and get to do that sort of thing, you got to have your blood up a little bit. You got to enjoy it and try to get others to enjoy it as well.
Exactly. It could be that person's first poetry reading in the audience, and you want to blow them away.
Oh, especially at a college. I mean, if you've got 50 students in a room and that can't get you going, then, you know, maybe that part of you is not there.
And half of those students may not even want to be there. They're being forced by their professor to be there for extra credit.
Sure.
So you want to blow them away and go, well, I'm going to change her attitude.
Yeah, I mean, and it's difficult for me to understand why someone's ego wouldn't play into that. Like, if I've got a captive audience, I want to put on a show for them. I want to do the best I can. And I think that performance angle is something underrated in some writers. Some writers just don't care, and that's fine. I mean, I do.
That's good that you do. Yeah, there are some who... I can't name any names, but there are some divas and the male equivalent thereof that I don't know if there's a word for.
Well, some don't care. Some think it's beneath them. Some just have that sort of attitude.
We come back to our question. Is steak beneath Kanye?
Is steak beneath Kanye? I believe so. You know, I think it's got to be a deer that he's raised and named and is bejeweled. And then the deer is killed in front of him and he eats a weird section that I don't know.
Instead of fat globules, there are diamonds.
There you go. If diamonds are small enough, you can swallow them, right? It's fine.
And God forbid you slip a cubic zirconia into that meat.
Because he would know.
He would know by the taste. He'd be like,
Kanye's got a refined palate for diamonds, okay?
He does indeed. Precious jewels are like Skittles to him.
That's right. And you and I, we can work our way through a flank steak. We'll be fine.
Do you ever get starstruck at AWP or anything like that? You go to these big writing conferences. Let's say you see somebody whose name you know, and you're like, oh, I know that person and everything. Do you fanboy at all, or do you manage to rein it in?
The last AWP I went to was in Austin, so it was a little bit ago. But I got to see Tim O'Brien, and I had read the things they carried in college, and I didn't go up to meet him, so I guess I was a little starstruck by him. Other than that, you know, most people there to sort of do their work and do their job and are pretty approachable at AWP. It's in the bigger crowds of when they're doing a reading for 500 people and things like that, that I would hesitate to introduce myself to anyone.
If they're just walking the floor, even then, I still don't like to bother them.
Well, yeah, I think unless you've had, and this is what probably drives them nuts, if you felt like you had a personal connection with something they wrote, you'd probably want to say something to them. And then there's the 400 other people that have said that same thing to them that day. So I understand trying to give them personal space, especially if, you know, if they're famous and they're just there to try to do a job. I get that. I think I was a little fanboy. I've been lucky enough to exchange some emails with Mark Jakic. I'm a big fan of Mark Jakic's poetry. And he's such a nice guy and to correspond. And Richard Sykin, who I'm a huge fan of, was nice enough to send a return email to me because I think I had sort of fanboy sent him an email and was just loving his first book, Crush, so much that I felt moved to send him a note about it. So there are still some people, maybe not the most famous people, but just people I'm so impressed with that I get anxious about it.
You hear about a new book of them coming down the pike and you're like, oh yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's about, probably a dozen or two dozen contemporary poets that part of it is, sort of awe at what they can do. And part of it is sort of my competitive hackles. And like, well, let's see what they've done now as sort of inspiration for what, you know, what I'm trying to work on and things like that.
That competitiveness, you mentioned sports culture earlier. Were you involved with sports when you were young?
I played baseball, basketball, tennis in high school. I didn't make it far in basketball as the third string point guard. But I played baseball up until I blew out my shoulder. I played tennis actually after that. And when I went to college, I got sort of drafted into playing lacrosse in college for a year. So there was a lot of sports, and that was, you know, when I was up until, let's say, the age of 12 or 13, I was still convinced I could play baseball as my career. And I got far enough that I was playing in fall leagues and things like that. And I got an offer, even though I'd blown out my shoulder, to go play at Ohio Dominican. So sports were a big part of me growing up, and that sort of competitiveness doesn't fade away easily, though maybe it should.
How were you in tennis? I'm curious.
I was a all conference. We won the conference, and I was first team. But it was more that I had athletic ability than I had tennis skill. I was used to training year round, and in high school tennis, there's not really a lot of athletes involved except at the highest level. So more often than not, I could just outrun people, and my lack of skill would get buried in that.
Your level of endurance would wear the other down.
Sure. Sure.
I can see that. I was on the high school tennis team, and, that was our worst year. It wasn't because of me. It was just that we just had a bad team.
You've carried it this far.
I've carried it this far. I haven't played really since then. I kind of miss it, to be honest. I miss playing tennis.
You know, I got to take my daughter a couple times, and we had a lot of fun sort of teaching her how. I was good enough. I got to be the Knox County tennis instructor for a couple years in the summer, and that was a lot of fun. They'd pay you 15, 20 bucks an hour to teach lessons to little kids all day. So that was fun.
I always had fun playing the sport. It's a lot of fun to play. It's, as I've grown older, though, and bad habits have seeped into my body, let's say.
Nobody's moving like a young man anymore.
My chair has wheels for a reason.
All right, right.
I do miss it, and I've thought about, okay, maybe I should work on, maybe at the gym, going more endurance so that I can build that up to maybe be able to play a set again.
Well, believe it or not, at the age of 33, I actually already have an arthritic kneecap. So a lot of the running around gets to me, fairly quickly. It's actually called catcher's knee. I played catcher for 12 years. And so I actually developed arthritis pretty early.
I developed a tennis elbow on my right knee.
Okay.
So a ball of water basically sitting on top of my kneecap.
Right, right.
From my high school days. So, and it's a fun party trick. I could still pull half my knee out and be like, check this out. You know?
Well, you know, if the party starts to die, you know what to do.
Exactly. If the party's dying, just go, hey guys, check this out.
Check out my weird knee.
Whoop. There you go. All right. I think I can do better, though, than that. I've got better party tricks.
Well, I'm sure you can juggle or something like that.
No, I can't, actually.
Oh, okay.
But I can just be a complete insane person and make sure. Everybody in the room go, all right, I'm paying attention to him.
Okay. Well, you can find the audience, and that's good.
Yeah. It's a skill.
Yes, sir.
Philip, I came out of theater, so that was my high school. It wasn't sport. It was theater.
Actually, I did that as well. I did. I'd be in plays, and I always got the role in the musical that didn't have to sing. Whatever the role was that had a bunch of lines but no actual singing, that was me.
Hmm. I could see that happening. I'm sure that happened to many of the students I went to high school with too.
That was, and we did at. I went to the College of Worcester for undergrad, and the senior thesis there is a big deal. You actually work on it for a year and a half. And I wrote and made a movie, so I got to do some acting then as well.
Neat.
Yeah, it was fun.
Do you still do much acting, like, or just occasionally when, you know, for fun or whatever?
You know what? I haven't done really any acting since I was working on a movie in grad school for a little bit and sort of quit. But all the stuff I learned and all the sort of process of that, I like to think that I take that into the performance of the readings and things like that.
Do you find using it in your writing at all?
I think there are techniques that you can pick up for maybe timing and things like that. Like, I don't use a lot of rhyme, but I think you can find a way with timing to still find music in the poetry, not necessarily rhyme patterns and things like that.
You can definitely find rhythms.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. But wait, we're talking about writing, and that's not what the show's about.
I understand.
We gotta get off of that. I don't know. Quick, think of another topic.
What sort of fish would Kanye eat? I assume from the South Park thing, it would be some sort of gay dolphin, but
possibly. Dolphin fish.
Sure, sure.
But he is rich, so he would want something exotic.
Right.
I'm thinking like some kind of deep sea angler fish that almost nobody would ever touch, and he would only eat it because no one else would touch it.
I like to think that he has a guy, he's got a shark guy that doesn't kill sharks for him, but drugs them so he can punch them to death and eat them.
Possibly.
You never know.
Either that or the guy breeds the sharks for Kanye.
I don't feel like it's going out too far on a limb for us to say these things. I think those are all possibilities.
There are many. I think Kanye is going to become our new American folk hero.
I think so.
There's the famous graphic of him, one of his tweets, where he said that my music saves lives, it's medicine, and somebody drew a graphic of a person stabbed to death on the street with a sword, and Kanye is stopping the EMS worker and singing to the person.
That's good, I like that.
So Kanye is out there as our, yeah, he could be a folk hero, seriously.
I think so. I think generations to come will look at him in that fashion.
Do we have any real folk heroes anymore in America?
There's too much availability of pictures and videos and story. Folk heroes can't really develop too much.
So we need to start that then. We need to create American folk heroes for the 21st century.
I think what used to be folk heroes are now sort of underground heroes that don't make it to the surface, maybe.
Well, if we were to take, let's say Kanye is one of them, who else would be good for an American folk hero now?
American folk heroes. Well, now that they've gotten most of the steroids out of baseball, there's not going to be any sort of, like, Babe Ruthian folk heroes.
And don't even get me started on Barry Bonds.
Not going to be Barry Bonds, no. You get the idea that one of these, you know, musical troubadours could be a folk hero.
Elvis is kind of a folk hero.
Elvis is a folk hero, I'd say.
There's rumors of him showing up at people's bus stops and everything, and he's still out there.
Excellent. He's still doing his work. That's good. Who else could be a folk hero? I'd say, wow, this is tough. Maybe acting-wise, what about George Clooney? Can we make George Clooney a folk hero?
I think Bill Murray is a good one.
Bill Murray is a good, because the way he keeps showing up in public and surprising people.
And nobody knows how to, apparently he doesn't have a phone or anything. You know, he does not receive calls from agents and such.
Well, I'm willing to grant him folk hero status. I'm not sure my children will.
Yeah, he's just, nobody knows where he is. He just, is there.
Sure. Which I imagine when you're trying to get him on set is a difficult thing, but for the rest of us, it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. It just suddenly pops up at somebody's frat house to do dishes.
Sure.
Shows up and gives a wedding speech for somebody else because he happens to be in the near area, you know?
Yeah.
I'd put Bill Murray, Kanye. There's got to be a few more out there that we could probably put in there as folk heroes. Tom Hanks, maybe.
Tom Hanks, he might have, yeah, I think he's got enough money to be weird and wild now, too. I think he could do some odd things.
And he's also probably the single nicest person in Hollywood, according to many people.
Sure.
Like, so he's genuinely a nice guy.
He's got no real mythology behind him, though. Is he too normal?
Yeah, he's just too normal.
Okay.
So I think that makes him a folk hero in Hollywood.
Sure, sure.
Canadian folk hero, I'd have to put Wayne Gretzky there.
You're not going to go with Neil Young?
No.
Okay.
I think Wayne Gretzky, you can't disparage Wayne. It's a Canadian crime.
Well, you know, of the few times I've almost ended up in jail in Canada, Wayne Gretzky was not part of those experiences, but he very well could have been if it got a little further down the line.
I dare not ask about you in Canada now.
That's probably good. All those warrants, if not forgotten about, then.
No, they have not been forgotten about.
Nope. Sure.
Yep.
I'd go with Wayne Gretzky as maybe the only Canadian folk hero that Americans are aware of anyway.
Did you spit on Rush or something while you were in Canada?
I threatened him. I didn't spit on him.
Well, fair enough. You know, as a Rush fan, though, I kind of now hate you, but that's okay. Yeah.
You know, you can't. Who's the drummer for Rush? Is that
Neil Peart?
Yeah. Well, he's a drumming icon. We'll give him that.
Okay. We'll give him that. So he's kind of a weird folk legend too.
Sure.
We'll leave it at that. So yeah, American folk legends. There needs to be new ones. But you're right. With media the way it is, we can't create folk heroes like we used to.
Well, and the sort of train system is dying, and that used to be where a lot of folk heroes would come from, and the logging system, you know, like Paul Bunyan, that's all on television now, so it's tough to find them.
Then we move to the American road story
okay.
of the 1950s and 60s. Do we still have that ability anymore either?
Like how, well, Kerouac was a folk hero, or at least an icon, maybe.
But, I mean, we have so many movies like National Lampoon's Vacation, Road Trip, all these, the Great American Traveling Story.
Well, there's still kitsch to find if you want to find it. But, yeah, I'd say for the most part, you know, that sort of died down. I still like a nice road trip if I can find someone willing to drive with me. But even then, it's more about getting to the dedication than it is about enjoying the ride, so...
Yeah, I wonder if we've lost that aspect of the road trip now, that it's all about getting to the destination.
Well, and even the cars themselves have become sort of entertainment mobiles with DVD players and satellite radio and things like that. So it's sort of, we're just going to entertain you as much as we can till we get you where you want to be, as opposed to allowing the landscape and the different stops to do that.
That's why I love going to rest stops and picking up all the brochures, because that's where you still see there are crazy people out there doing crazy things.
The world's biggest whatever, yeah.
Yeah, or come to the quilting museum. It's our only feature.
I had a friend's sister who would do sort of kitsch trips like this, and she would stop at like a dinosaur-themed motel and things, which always just sounded like great fun to me.
Yeah, you can still do a tour of New Jersey diners. Still has the largest number of diners per state, I think, in the country.
If it's a pie tour, I'm in. Any sort of pie tour, I will join.
So you're a pie person.
Big pie person.
Favorite pie?
Strawberry rhubarb.
Good choice.
I got spoiled by my mom growing up. She was a baker. So she would hand make the crust and do different pies during the year. And still to this day, I can sort of rattle her a little bit and tell her that I bought a pie from Kroger's or a different grocery store. And within a week, she will bake a pie and try to throw out what I've bought.
So you can guilt trip her then?
I can, a little bit, and it's good. I feel no guilt in doing it myself.
Did you take up her baking abilities? Did you find you inherited them?
I can cook pretty much anything, but baking-wise, my wife and I have undertook making a pie a few times to varying results. But I've tried to learn a little bit from her, but I haven't quite been able to pick it up yet.
So you've made the inedible pie.
I've made the inedible pie. The last one we made was a blueberry pie that was actually pretty good, but still not quite to the level of Gene. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to cook?
My favorite thing, especially when I get to have people over, I love making paella. That's the go-to big meal dish with the rice and all the vegetables and seafood and meat. And it takes about 6 hours to do, but it's a lot of fun.
Mental note, if I come up to Ohio, you make paella.
That's a deal. I can do that.
Because I have not had a good paella in years.
Oh, yeah. As long as you got the right broth and are depending on what kind of meats you eat, we can go even crazy with that. Or you can just do seafood. But if you give yourself enough time, because I only have the one kitchen. If you got multiple kitchens, it would only take 2 hours. But it's just great. And it's such a social thing to eat if you got a big enough pan. And it's just a lot of fun.
Best one I ever had was in New York City, small Spanish restaurant called El Quixote in Manhattan.
Okay.
Went there, excellent paella, but their deal was if you and your table finished the paella, they brought you a second paella.
Oh, man.
If you finish the second paella somehow, they give you a third paella.
Oh, wow.
And any paella beyond number one is free. So that's
nice. It also sounds like a threat, but...
Yeah. It practically is like, oh, this was great paella and everything. Congratulations. Have another. And you try working your way through a second full paella and you're like, kill me now.
Those are the best people, aren't they?
Exactly. And then they're like, here, have a third one. No, please, God, no. What is Spanish for stop? Please.
Alto?
Exactly.
Okay.
I think it is. My Spanish is so limited, as noted by the last Saftacast promo.
Oh, I have that. All of my bad grades in college and grad school were from foreign language classes. So the rest of my grades were all right.
I wonder why they make us in grad school learn a second language again.
Well, and in ours at Miami it had to be French. And I had no experience with French. So I ended up having to teach myself to pass a test to get the degree. And so that was a bit of a debacle. But it got done eventually.
Yeah, I totally understand. When I was in my grad school program, they made us do French, and it was basically like a 2-week course. That's it.
Okay.
And so having no experience with French, having not done a second language for over 10 years at that point, yeah, that was not a fun 2 weeks.
Well, for writers, it's a different part of our brain. It's the same part of the brain that's good at math. We learn math the same way we learn foreign languages because it's just a different language. And that's not my strength.
Math?
I can do simple math like the wind, but when we get into algebras and calculus and things like that, I start to lose my footing.
Yeah, I can do basic four function.
Yep.
And I know what base 10 kinda is.
Okay, well that's good, see?
But beyond that, I'm screwed.
Yeah, I lucked out that I got my college credit for math in high school, and so I just had to take a couple science classes. Otherwise, I would have been in trouble.
Damn, I had to take a basic math course in college. I pulled a C+. That's all I needed. I was happy with it. I was done.
Yeah, that's the only reason I even attempted it in high school, was just so I wouldn't have to attempt it in college.
Be done with it. Over.
Yes, sir.
Did you know going into college that you were going to go into English?
That was one of the degrees I was looking into. I was still sort of in the athletic mode and was thinking that, I could do sports writing, at the time. But by the time I got to the middle of my freshman year, I was all about poetry. So that happened pretty fast.
What changed you?
More just reading. I read, in high school, got into Joseph Heller and Vladimir Nabokov, and the Nabokov thing never went away. The movie I made for my senior thesis was adapting his first novel, Mary, and adapting that into a screenplay and making that into a movie. So Nabokov never went away. But when I got into college and finally got exposed to the poets outside of the anthology you're handed in high school, that was a big deal.
Do you do that with your classes? Because you're an instructor, right?
Yeah.
Do you do that with your classes, or do you stick strictly to whatever's given in the textbook, or are you allowed to go off script?
Well, I've taught at the same place long enough that I can teach all the things they want me to and find room to teach the things I want to as well. So they get a little bit extra from me.
good deal.
Yeah.
I will give them a little bit from the book to start them with poetry, but then I just go completely off script with it.
Yeah, well, most of my, because I teach at a smaller school, like a career college. So most of that is based in essay writing. And so there wouldn't be any poetry or literature unless I made there be. And I make sure every time. I'm teaching a speech class right now as well. And I made the whole speech about gravitas and owning the room. I got to give them this past week. And made it a poetry thing. And anytime they bring in something to sort of perform, they get extra credit for that.
So you're doing a little subtle subterfuge there when it comes to literature.
Just to make it fun.
Just to make it fun for yourself.
Exactly.
Forget what the students think. You're making it fun for yourself.
Well, I tend to enjoy it enough that at least a few of them latch onto that.
Passion is important there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So you started out originally not wanting to go into English necessarily, and then it just all kind of happened then in the first year.
Yeah, I mean, it's a school where they don't really actually encourage you to pick a major till maybe your sophomore, junior year. And I was certain by the time it got to December of my freshman year that that's what I was going to spend all my time doing. I ended up getting a religious studies minor by accident. But that was just because one professor, his name was Dr. Charles Kammer, was so incredible that I just took all of his classes. And they said, if you sign this paper, you're a religious studies minor now. So I did.
I was about to ask, how do you get an accidental minor?
I took all of his classes, and my advisor brought it up to me and said, if you just sign this, you'll have a minor. I said, okay. There was no extra thesis or anything, so.
Hey, it doesn't hurt to have it on your degree, you know?
There you go. I just kept taking Dr. Kammer's classes and enjoying all those.
Have you patterned your teaching after people like that?
Yeah, I mean, there was anyone who could be passionate in the classroom, which is difficult sometimes in the tenured people. But anyone who can come into a room and just get everyone excited about learning anything, whatever it was. I wasn't necessarily that interested in religion, but some of the theories and thoughts that this man had on the world were incredible to me. And he delivered them with such a passion that that's you know, you don't want to walk into a room where people are going to be looking at you and be passionless. Going back to both the readings and teaching, I mean, you've got to have just a little bit of enthusiasm, or it's going to be boring for everybody.
You have to have a fire in you.
Sure.
Totally understand that. Going into readings, even if you feel that day like you're not on your best, you can't throw your A game down, you've got to try your damnedest.
Well, and part of that comes back from you talked about some of the musicals and acting things. I think some of that comes from acting, where, you know, the show starts and you perform, even if you've had a crappy day or aren't in your best frame of mind or anything like that. I think the lights come on and you do your thing if you've been trained well enough.
Whatever's bothering you that day stays outside the stage.
Sure.
Lock it outside the stage doors when you walk in.
Yep.
I feel that way doing this kind of podcast or anything, you kind of have to do the same thing too.
Yeah.
You have to go into it going, all right, doesn't matter what's going on later after this. Right, sure. Now, we focus on this.
Well, and that's what makes you engaging, and that what, you know, you're the constant in the show, and if you come unenthused to it, you know, the person you're talking to is not going to be enthusiastic. The people listening aren't going to be enthusiastic. It's going to be difficult.
You have to keep a mentality, too, that this could be someone's first time listening to the program.
Sure.
So you have to make it entertaining.
Well, and we were talking about readings and things like that, especially in the world of poetry. If you can get someone excited at a poetry reading, so many poetry people are poetry lifers, I call them, where if you can engage them on a real level, they care about poetry so much that they're going to carry you with them for their entire experience with poetry. So many people get so ingrained in that community that it's a big deal. And if you can make allies, you know, they'll read what you write till they're done reading.
And teach it too.
Sure.
I've taught many of my friends in my classes.
I've gotten lucky enough, not former friends, but friends of mine who are teachers at different places have taught my first book, I think three or four different schools, and it's just fantastic to hear that kind of thing.
Do you get students contacting you?
I do, especially the Wisconsin gig when I went up there and I met with four or five classes and did a reading and things like that. I got emails from different people asking me to read some things, help them out. What do you think about this? And you know that I get excited that they're excited, and I get back to them as quickly as I can. I've got a website, and people will send me messages and notes through that, and some of them are just, you know, we appreciate this, we like this, but if they want to have a discussion about something, that's great. Let's talk poetry. I never get tired of that.
Bring it on, you know. Bring it on, kid.
And some of the ways that I've seen, you know, some of the poets that have gotten to places that I'd like to get, seen them handle themselves in that way, that's inspirational to me. I mean, you know, I know who I am. I know who they are. Why not lend yourself to whoever's willing to listen?
Very good point. Why not make yourself available if someone...
Sure.
Considering how low on the totem pole of entertainment poetry has become...
Yes, sir.
You kind of go for it.
Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be, you know, that little rush of excitement that someone likes something you did. That doesn't go away. We spend so much of our time... sort of hidden working on something that when it's received in any way positive, you know, you still get that rush. It still feels great.
Definitely. I know that feeling. And yeah, it's just fantastic. How's the press been for your latest book that you just had come out, I believe, this week?
I think the pre-order copies are going to go out on Tuesday. I got my big box this week, which was great. Main Street Rag's been good. They picked it out in last January, I think, and were on the ball enough that it's already out. And they put together a great cover, and it looks beautiful. I'm really super proud of what ended up coming out of it. It was a different experience than the one from my first book, but it was still really nice. And M. Scott Douglas, who's running it, is a really good guy, and his readers seem to be on the ball. So
that is awesome to have. It's always good to have a good press behind you on something.
Yeah, and he my first press, and actually they're going to do my third and fourth book as well. Is Eighth House Publishing, and it was a very different setup where it was sort of slower. And for the first book, I met with an editor for six straight weekends. We'd meet on Skype. And we'd hash out everything. And I haven't started editing the third book yet, but with Main Street and M. Scott, he said, "No, we love this book. Look for typos, but we don't need to work on it." Which was interesting. And at first, I had some trepidation about, because I sort of saw what that process was like for the first book and how the book got better. So I sort of took the onus on myself to make sure that it was exactly what I wanted it to be, before, you know, it was signed and delivered to go to press. But it was nice to have that confidence from him. We wouldn't accept this if it wasn't great.
We wouldn't accept it if it was pretty much done at this point.
Right. And different editors, you know, have different opinions on that. I know from speaking with Erin at SAFTA, she likes a project that's not quite there, and she likes to work with them and turn it into something great. And that's sort of what my first experience was like. So this experience was different. It was still good, and it was great to get that sort of confidence from them in the book.
It was just different, that was all.
Yeah, it was different, but it was good. And the result was, if not as good, better this time. It was a different project, and one that ended up took a lot of research and a lot of writing to pull off. I think every younger poet spends a lot of time writing about themselves and the things around them. To take something to research and write poems that way was new. And to get it, to have them been received the way that they have, has been just great.
Sounds awesome, man. You know, it does. Are you the type of poet that is more... Damn it, we're getting on writing again.
we'll move on to movies and crime soon.
All right, we'll move on to movies and crime. So,
yeah,
what should we talk about when it comes to movies and crime?
Oh, movies and crime.
Is it okay to pirate movies?
I can't say on something that would be listened to.
I can't comment on that topic.
I've never pirated movies myself. Have I been in the room where one was put on? Yes.
Possibly. It is possible that I was in the general vicinity of a movie that should not have been on YouTube.
It was generally fuzzy.
You could pull the Reagan defense.
Sure.
I have no memory of that.
Well, you know, I'm almost old enough to pull that off. 33 is old enough to start forgetting things, right?
I was forgetting stuff at around then, yeah. I think about the time I got married.
There you go.
Was when it started falling apart.
That's when you need a short memory.
Exactly. You start losing your mind once you get married.
Sure.
Slowly. My wife is not going to kill me for what I just said.
Oh, your wife's a sweetheart.
She will still kill me, though, for what I just said.
I'm saying she can. I'm not, you know.
She can. I swear, I think she's got a list of things that she's going to kill me for, and she's just going to hold on to it.
Well, hopefully she reads them all before she kills you. You'll get to relive all your wrongdoings.
It'll be like the Declaration of Independence. Here are all the crimes that you've committed.
And now she's going to set you free from your life.
Exactly. I'm going to free you from the burden that is breathing.
That's right.
So movies, then.
Sure.
Bring it on. What's your thought on them? Or on specific ones, or...
You know, when I was, let's say 10 years ago, I was very much into, like, David Gordon Green and John Cassavetes and anything that was independent and sort of small and cool. And now I'm honestly to the point where I get really excited about blockbusters and things like that.
Is that because of children? Has children changed your movie enjoyment habits?
Well, what I get to see in the small amount of time I have to see movies is immediately halved by having children. Where, you know, I've seen Frozen 30 times, and I've seen Kung Fu Panda movies a lot, and I've seen Guardians of the Galaxy. There's a Galaxy movie that's got Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, and so I see a lot of those, Brave, things like that. That's about half the movies I get to see. So when I see something that I'm going to go out and see more often than not, I'm like, well, let's blow some shit up. Let's see some action, kind of thing, or let's laugh a lot.
I want mindless entertainment.
Yeah, for the most part. And I think part of it, I tried to explain this to a friend of mine. I've got a great friend, John Oswalt, who was my freshman roommate and been great friends with me ever since. And we used to go see movies together. That'd be our thing when I was in undergrad and grad school. We had a friend who would want to use our room for his girlfriend, and he would pay us to go see movies to vacate the area. And so we see movies a lot. And he asked me about this, why I wanted to see like Iron Man 2, and why I wanted to see Prometheus, and why I wanted, you know, Darren, I thought you wanted to see this like small budget thing. And I tried to explain it to him, and the best I came up with was, you know, I spend a lot of my free time in sort of the artistic realm. If I get enough time during the day to see a movie as well, I'd like something to sort of just wash over me and entertain me.
I know that feeling. When I was in grad school and having gone through a semester of reading heavy, intense books and narratives and theory and everything, all I wanted was something stupid like The Onion.
Sure, yeah.
The brain is just completely burnt out on intellectual things.
Well, and I'll have enough people sort of send me messages about, well, you got to see this. This is brilliant. This is incredible. Go check it out. Like, I still need to go see Boyhood. And a lot of people have, all my friends that like movies have told me to see that. And I've liked Richard Linklater movies for a long time, so that should be good. But unless I'm sort of pushed into it, I'm very much choosing the hour and a half to 2 hours of just bright lights and stars sort of stuff.
So there's the crime angle right there. It's a crime that you've given up the intellectual movies for the cinematic blockbuster, Michael Bay.
It's not something I'm proud of. It's just something that's happened.
So maybe having children does change your movie habits like that, then.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, you've got... If half of your movie-going time is going to be spent with animated characters and movies based around animals, and the other half is going to be limited to the point where you can't see all the things you want. And I've got one of my good writing friends, a professor of mine, his name's David Schloss. He goes and sees independent movies all the time. He used to go, when I was in grad school, I'd run into him at a theater called the Esquire in Cincinnati all the time. And he goes and he sees everything. Well, right now his daughter's in college, And he's in semi-retirement, so he gets to do that kind of thing. And I would love to do that as well, but I'm busy.
I think that's what's my retire. I think we just solidified my retirement plan now.
Oh, have a great independent theater next to a great Thai food place and a record store. Hell yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe not a Thai food place for me, okay. But you know, we'll put a coffee bar right next to it.
There is a coffee bar right next to it.
Then we're set. Then I'm moving to Ohio. That's it. I'm moving to Ohio where there's independent cinemas, record stores, and coffee bars.
We would love to have you.
That's paradise to me. Actually, I've never had a problem with Ohio when I've traveled through it.
Well, and so far you've got a promise of semi-retirement and a promise of paella. So
that's true.
It's just piling up, sir.
And I can continue my tradition of annoying everybody in the car when we pass through Cincinnati by singing the theme to WKRP in Cincinnati.
There it is. Not many people can do that, even in Ohio anymore.
No, I drove my parents nuts with it. First time we were traveling through it, and I'm probably like 18, 19 years old. We start hanging in Cincinnati. Like, oh, we're near Cincinnati. I just went, baby, have you ever wondered... wondered whatever became of me, and my parents are like, oh, shut up. And I'm like, 20 minutes later, I'm still going on it.
Sure,
driving them nuts. But that's the way. So we're close to the end here.
Okay,
how did this go by so fast?
We were having fun.
That's the key, right? Yes, there. So second book has just dropped. Let's talk about what you got. That's obviously the big news coming out in your world right now.
Yeah, last year my first book came out, and this year, Temporary Champions, it's a collection of poetry about the Ray Mancini and Duk Koo Kim title fight from 1982.
Okay, I definitely need to get a copy of that.
Kim died at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, that was just the beginning of the madness. So his mom, who had sort of married up and tried to gain wealth that way in Korea, saw her son as the meal ticket at that point, and then he died. So she went home and killed herself. The girlfriend who was pregnant with his child tried to marry him after he died. And then the referee who was in charge of the fight, Richard Green, was either killed by the mob or killed himself. And then Mancini, and where sort of I got started on it, was he's an Ohio kid. He's a Youngstown.
Yep, out of Youngstown.
Boy. He only had three fights after that, and he lost two of them, and then started training Mickey Rourke, of all things. So the story itself had caught me, and then I spent enough time. I had no idea how to write anything about boxing, and so through research and things like that, and the fight is on YouTube. You can watch it. It was a nationally broadcast fight. It was the Saturday Night Entertainment for America, and a man died at the end of it, which was crazy.
And Warren Zevon wrote a good song about it, too.
He wrote a pretty good song. Sun Kil Moon did a great song called Duk Koo Kim.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. And so through the research and all the things that I learned about boxing, it took a while. It took about 3 months to do all the research to start writing it. And then it only took about 4 or 5 months to write the big cache of poems before it got edited down was about 250 of them. So it took a lot of time, and it was definitely something different. But now that it's done and it's out, I'm just really, really proud of what it looks like and what it is.
Well, I can't wait to get my hands on a copy of it and read it, because I was obsessed with boxing as a teenager.
Sure.
So I'm looking forward to reading this one, Darren. So people can buy it where?
You can buy it on Main Street Rag's website.
MainStreetRags.com?
Yeah, MainStreetRagPublishing.com, I think it is. Or you can just Google me in the book and you'll find it. It's called Temporary Champions, which is another crazy thing about it. They were all the press conferences that lead up to boxing matches are all like very verbose talk, all grandiose. And they all talk about, you know, that guy's going to kill that guy. And Mancini's manager came out and said that this was going to prove that Mancini wasn't a temporary champion, that he was a champion for the history of all time. And then he killed a man. So it's...
Well, he is now a champion for history.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wasn't lying there.
But you can find the book at Main Street's website. And I'll be doing different readings all over. I've got the Ohio book launch for it coming up on November 5th at Bossy Girls here in Columbus. So that'll be fun.
Cool. And where can folks at home find you other than, say, Facebook? You mentioned your own website earlier.
Yeah, just DarrenCDemery.com. I update things when something gets picked up to be published. When any sort of online thing comes out, I'll put a link up. When the print mags come up, I'll put a link to be able to buy the print mags. There's a link there to the 9-word poems. I write a poem for each Cleveland Indians game every season, and things like that. So there, Twitter, Facebook, you can just send me a note that way.
And Twitter, you're just, I'm guessing, Darren C. Demery there?
DC Demery. D_C_Demery.
Gotcha.
Yes, sir.
Well, folks should be on the lookout for you, man, because it sounds like you got some great stuff coming out right now.
It's going to be fun. And then next July, the third book will be out, and we'll have more fun with that.
Excellent, man. It has been great talking with you.
Thank you very much, sir.
It has been great. We got to have you back sometime, I think. Maybe when the third book drops, we can have you back on.
That sounds good.
All right. You take care, Darren.
All right. My best to you, sir.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.